And again, one of the reasons why that the Buddha taught jhanas, one of the reasons why monks like myself keep on pushing jhanas, is because not just it makes a nice experience and you bliss out during a retreat and you want to come back next time, it's because that when you enter these jhanas, you get these experiences of, first of all, a doer disappearing. There's something has gone which you thought was yours. There's something gone which you thought was you. And it's not just gone for just a moment. It's gone for a long time. It's like, basically, you're sitting here and your arm disappears. Wait, where did that go? I thought that was mine. I thought it belonged to my body. How can you have a body without an arm? Well, there it is. That's really weird. If you see your arm just coming and going, it becomes quite clear it doesn't belong to you. If you see like your leg coming and going, that doesn't belong to you. If you see the doer disappearing for long periods of time, it becomes just as obvious as the nose on the front of your face. This thing doesn't belong to you. You can exist without it. And actually, you exist much happier without it. Without a doer. When I'm talking about a doer, I'm talking about all manifestations of will, choice, decision-making, judging. All of that disappears in these states. It's the simile I usually give for these jhanas. It's like a person, or like a tadpole born in the water. A tadpole born in the water, grown up in the water, only knows water. Actually, he doesn't know very much about water because it's just too close. It's got nothing to compare it with. And thinks that's the whole world. It's only when the tadpole grows up and leaves that water, becomes a frog and goes to dry land. He's got that extra data to the world. It's only when you go to dry land that you know what wet means. It's only when you can actually get out of the doer and the doer disappears that you know what the doer was. That you know what it truly is. It's just water. It's not the whole world. It's just part of nature. It's not your essential being. So once you enter a jhana and experience the jhanas and come out afterwards, just usually they're so strong experiences, so marvelous, powerful experiences, that most people, they just get off, wow, that was really nice, wow, that's really nice. But in Buddhism, we also teach not just to indulge in the pleasure of having attained these states, but also to review them, look back upon them, and investigate them. What was that? Powerful experiences are very easy to remember. You can recall them just so well. And you look back and see what was strange about that, what was enjoyable about that. And one thing you look back on is to see that the doer has completely gone. What does that actually mean? If you look back upon that enough times, you've come to the insight inevitably. You have to. I can't see how you can miss it. That a great part of you, a great chunk, which you thought was you, which you took to be yourself, which you assumed to be yourself, was a great mistake. You just summed it up all wrong. You made an assumption without all the evidence. And now the evidence is here. You can't keep that assumption again. Just like, you know, people always used to think that the world was flat. It's obvious, isn't it, the world is flat. Just go and look outside. It's flat. You can even put a spirit level on it. There, it's flat. And actually, for most people, sort of, you know, that's obvious. The world is round, takes a jump of perception. Especially if somehow you can leave the world and go up in a rocket or a spaceship. And you can actually see the world is round. The same with the doer being a self. Right down here, unenlightened human beings, it's just so obvious that the doer is a self, that I am doing these things, that I am choosing. We make that assumption all the time. It's only if we can somehow get apart, away, separated from this, get a perspective on it, see the doer disappear, only then it becomes very clear that the doer has nothing to do with the self. The doer has gone, and existence is still there. You're still conscious, still feels like you there, but the doer has gone. Consciousness has remained. Imagine what it's like if you actually could see this and understand this and accept this. It completely changes your perspective on willpower, on choosing, on doing, on desiring, on craving. What is craving anyway, but another type of doing? If you can actually see this, the doer is not self, a lot of craving disappears. Also, the other part which one assumes to be a self is just experiencing consciousness. Even though if we attain to at least a first jhana, we can actually experience for ourselves the doer ceasing, there's still like a conscious experience there. One is still fully awake, one is still knowing. But little by little, that knowing disappears. If you can develop another jhana at least, and you see a whole heap of knowing disappearing as the jhanas get more and more refined, a whole chunk of consciousness disappearing, then again you can get an idea, an inkling that consciousness isn't you. But not only that, because in the Dhamma, in Buddhism, the Buddha sort of described consciousness is actually what it actually is in terms of the six senses, and describe that each of these senses has got a completely different type of consciousness to it. Sight consciousness, seeing, is not the same as hearing. It's not the same as smelling, tasting, touching, or mind consciousness. But why is it that we call each of these things consciousness as if it was the same thing? Why is it that we assume that it's like a continuity of knowing? What is it which seems to be the same between seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching? And this is where the experiences of jhanas start to let you understand the illusion of continuity in consciousness, which gives us the illusion that this is always me here, rather than the reality of the fragmentary nature of consciousness. The one consciousness arising and passing away, and a completely different consciousness arising and then passing away. Like you're given the simile in the monastery, it's like you're sitting here and now you're a banana, and then the banana completely vanishes, and then you're a mango, and the mango completely vanishes, and then you're a melon, and the melon particularly vanishes, then you're a banana again, and that vanishes, then you're an apple, and that vanishes, then you're a mango again. If that was your experience, that you're a completely different fruit every moment, then would you ever think that it was actually something sort of continuing across from one moment to another? Would you actually think there's some sort of identity which was there in the banana, which is there in the apple, which is there in the mango, and so on? That's actually the fragmentary nature of consciousness. Now, the reason why people don't see this is because whatever you say see with the eyes, the mind also sees. it takes up as an object of its own consciousness. You see something, you know you see. Seeing something is sight consciousness. Knowing you see this is mind consciousness. You hear something, you know you hear. Sound consciousness followed immediately by mind consciousness. You smell, taste, you touch something, you know you've touched it. Sound consciousness followed by mind consciousness. Even you imagine something, you know you imagined it. A thought arises, you know you thought that thought. You know something, you know you know. You know? What's happening here is even with mind consciousness, whatever arises in the mind can take that again as its object. Mind consciousness following on mind consciousness. The reality, the truth, if you're going to be more accurate, more precise, it's not that you know you know. It's that you know you knew. If you add that time factor there, this whole process of what we call self-consciousness becomes quite clear. It's just the mind taking up the last object of consciousness and repeating it again. And it's because mind consciousness is there with what we see, what we hear, what we smell, what we taste, what we touch. It gives the illusion of sameness. In that similar I have of the different fruit arising, manifesting. It's like an apple arises with a coconut next to it. And then there's a banana, they both disappear. Then there's a banana arises with a coconut next to it. And then there's an apple arises with a coconut next to it. And then there's a mango with a coconut next to it. And then it's back to a banana with a coconut next to it. And there's a coconut with a coconut next to it. And there's a banana again with a coconut next to it. The coconut stands for the mind consciousness. Always holding on to the other consciousnesses. Always being there with it. Giving the illusion of sameness. And what happens if you get into jhanas is that there all you've got is coconuts. All there you've got is just mind consciousness. All the other five consciousnesses have completely disappeared. Only if you have the jhanas do you really understand what the mind is, what mind consciousness is, what a coconut is. Because you've separated it out, you've distilled it, you've purified it. You know what this thing, mind, consciousness, experience, actually is, rather than just thinking about it or philosophizing about it. Once you recognize this sixth consciousness, call it citta, call it vijnana, mana, whatever you wish, once you understand what that actually is, mind or mind consciousness, then when you come out of jhanas, you can see it. Instead of just having this apple coconut or mango coconut and thinking it's just one fruit, with sort of a sameness to it, you can actually split off mind consciousness. You can actually see. There is seeing. The mind consciousness comes up right next. You can recognize it because you've seen it in its purity alone. And you can actually see sound consciousness, and then mind consciousness come up right afterwards. What you actually see, if you can recognize what mind or citta or consciousness truly is you can actually take apart the sensory experience. You can actually see the fragmentary nature of it. Banana, then coconut. apple, then coconut. There's nothing which is there all the time. Consciousness changes. 6 types, each completely different. Which one is you? The Buddha asked. If you are consciousness, if the conscious experience is the identity which you say is yourself and soul, if it's you which sees, which one is it? Which is you? Or is it, where do you go when that one which is you disappears and one of the other 5 is there? It just does not make sense. It cannot hold. You can never look again at consciousness once you see it fragmentary as being a self, being a soul, being a me, being mine. So only if consciousness is continuous, has got this continuity about it, can you think it's a self or a soul, it's something which belongs to you. Also, when you can see it's fragmentary, that it passes away, you can allow it to go. You can let it stop. When you see, especially these two, what I call the abodes of the delusion of self, the doer and consciousness, the will and consciousness, you can see that each one of these is, can never be regarded as a self, a me or a mine. Nothing to do with this. And there's no other place where a self can hang out. Then you just see that consciousness is just a process, a natural process. It's nothing to do with a person or a being. It's just something which arises and passes away according to causes. Same as will. It's something which arises and passes away because of causes. When it doesn't belong to you, then you can let it go. You can let it cease. You can let it end. Only then can nibbana be possible. Nibbana, the ceasing of all of this. It's very clearly described what nibbana is by the Buddha. When a flame goes out, it's nibbana. Where does it go out to? Does it go and become unified with the great flame being? Does it go to sort of some great home where all flames go to, but you can't see them, but they're really there? The Buddha actually said, does the flame go east? No. Does it go west? No. Does it go up? Does it go down? Does it go anywhere? No, it's just gone out. That's what nibbana means. What was once there is now finished. Gone. The process has ended. You can only allow that to happen. It only makes sense. It can only be a possibility for you if you realize that none of this has an essence to it. And none of this has a self to it. None of this belongs to you or belongs to anyone. It's just part of nature. Because people say, well, what's the point of all of this? If it's just going to end, you're just going to poof and you're gone. I don't want to go. Why don't you want to go? Because you think you're still there. Because what are you hanging on to? You don't want to nibbana. What have you got a vested interest in? What do you think you own? Who is this owner which you are not willing to sort of recognize as emptiness? If you can actually understand this and fully recognize and penetrate non-self, then you understand what nibbana means. And only then you understand what the Buddha was talking about the process, a natural process, which leads to the cessation of all of this. And basically, the people say, well, that might sound okay, but I'm not having anything to do with this. That maybe I don't want to nibbana, I just want to have a good time. And again, unfortunately, you've got no say in it. That's what I told quite a few people on this retreat. Is they say, well, you know, I've got maybe a few doubts. I'm not really quite sure whether I really want to sort of carry this meditation all the way to jhanas and, you know, become a monk or become a nun and sort of let go of everything and get into nirvana. I'm not quite sure of this. I say, no, don't worry about it because you've got no choice. It's very much like you get on a bus. And once you're on that bus, you can shout the driver to let me off at this stop. But unfortunately, it's an express bus with only one stop. And it's not going to sort of, there's no little buttons to press to get the driver to stop. You're on this until the end. And it has to eventually end up with letting everything go. It's abandoning things, giving up things. First of all, you give up what's outside. Then you start giving up what's inside. Inside, outside is the same. You give up everything until there's nothing left. It's a beautiful, that's what we call emptiness, going out, disappearing. Because you realize there was nothing there, only an illusion. The illusion has been seen, and everything grinds to a halt. So give that a go. See what happens when you completely let go. Only letting go from the imagination of there's no one in here. There's no one doing anything. Just take on that perspective and just see what happens. So, any questions on that talk this evening? Is there any difference between craving and that thing which you view as self? It's the wrong view which actually creates the craving. It's the cause of the craving. It's one of the things which you've heard me say here before. But as a young monk, I was always hearing this craving and non-attachment. And so I tried to practice non-craving. I'm not going to crave anything. But that was craving. I'm craving not to crave. There's a story of this monk who has had his alms bowl in front of him. And he's had some beautiful food that day, and he says, no, this is just attachment. He pushed it away. And he said, but that's just being attached to, you know, giving up. So he pulled it towards him. But then that's just attachment to eating. So he pushed it away again. And he spent 5 minutes pushing his bowl away and pushing it back again. So trying to get rid of attachment by attaching. And you get very confused in this way. The way I said it, I always was trying to give up things, but I could never do it. I was trying not to crave, but then craving would come up. And after a while, you know, you ask yourself, well, how can I not give up craving? So how can I give up craving? Because if I give up craving, that's a craving. You get all confused. And you realize that I gave the simile, and I've given it here. It's like a simile of a hand, because like craving is like sort of reaching out for something. Attachment is like picking it up. Well, I looked at my hand, just basic experience of existence. You know, ever since I've had this hand, it's always picking up things. It's picked up something now, look. Just put it down. And I'm sure in a few minutes I'll pick up something else, because that's what this hand does. It's always been doing this. And it always will do this. That's the nature of a hand. To pick things up. So how am I going to stop picking things up? How am I going to stop attaching to things? There I go again. How am I going to stop attaching to things? And the only way, I said, as long as you've got a hand, you're going to pick things up and attach to it. And I realize it's the same with the self. If you have a view, there's someone in there, you will always have craving. That's what a self does. That's its nature, that's its function. It craves, attaches. The crave is like going out trying to own something, trying to possess something. When it actually gets its object of craving, it wants to possess it and own it. All those things which you've craved for and worked hard for, what do you call them? Mine. You know, your guitar, all that, all your knowledge, which you've really worked hard for, is my knowledge, my degree. You know, the people which you've, you know, worked hard to build up a relationship with, my wife, my husband. This body which you've worked so hard through craving to build up so it's nice and fit and healthy, my body. You find whatever it is you think is yours will be coming from a sense of self. Craving originates from the illusion of self. As long as you've got that illusion of self, as long as you think you are, that you exist, there's a me, there's a doer, there's a knower, you'll always be craving. If you think there's a doer there, that you are the doer, it'll always be like the craving to control. If you think there's a knower, it'll always be the craving to experience more and more. That's what we do. So once you see the source of craving, it's the illusion of self, at least you realize that the only way to abandon craving is to uncover that illusion. And once you uncover that illusion, craving is mortally wounded. You're just going to die. That's why they say it's 7 lifetimes at most. And you haven't got a choice in this. That's why that if you see the Buddha's Dhamma, if you see it on self, there's just no way in the world you can decide I'm going to sort of put off my enlightenment and just live forever and ever and ever and keep getting reborn. Because you've got no choice. Choice is completely conditioned by all of this. Just you're letting go. Letting go happens. The hand has been cut off. And just all those things you picked up in the past because you had a hand now will be falling away. Falling away. You won't be picking up very much else. Does that make any sense to you? If you look in the Buddha's suttas, the Buddha said that the origin of craving is avijja. It's a delusion. What feeds delusion is the 5 hindrances. 5 hindrances will stop you actually seeing the nature of the mind, stop you attaining jhanas. Buddha also said, one of the powerful teachings which is in the suttas, he said that it's only if you can grasp the nimitta of the mind, citta nimitta. Basically, you know, you see what the mind is in jhanas. Only then can you get stream entry. Can you get the right view of non-self. Any other question or comment? We just end, and sometimes people think that it's so meaningless. But isn't that sort of why do we demand that life has meaning? And what actually is this thing about meaning and entertainment? Sometimes, you know, we say, like, why is this? Why should it be like this? And those sort of questions really sort of don't make much sense. It's like, why is a flower a flower? It's a question which doesn't make any sense, and it's coming actually from the sense of the illusion of self trying to protect itself. As one of the monks once described it, that he was doing the investigation into a self. What did he take to be a self, and getting into like the consciousness, and he felt himself almost like doing a battle with this illusion that something wouldn't let him go any deeper. There's a thing that I don't want to view things in this way. There's something which is very I'm very protective of. It's, you know, if you don't want to see something, you won't. It's called denial, basically. this is that old story. I'll repeat it. I'm sure many of you have heard this before. Because this fellow had his pet dog got very sick, and he took it to the vet. It's, you know, it's one of these big Doberman dogs. And the vet took one look at it and said, "I'm very sorry that your dog is dead." And he wouldn't believe it because, you know, he loved this little dog. And, you know, he denied it could be dead. He said, "It's just sick. You know, sort of, you know, heal it." He said, "Look, your dog is dead." And he said, "No, it's not." And so the fellow just went to one of the cages and he got out a cat. Someone left the cat there. And he took the cat by the tail and just dangled it in front of the Doberman's nose. You know what a Doberman would do if there's a cat next to his nose. And the Doberman was absolutely silent. He wouldn't move. And just to convince this fellow, he took the cat and put it round the dog's backside. And it, you know, where its sensitive areas are. And rolled it on its stomach and put the cat, actually rubbed the cat on its stomach, on its back, by its ears. And the cat was meowing and hissing. And the dog wasn't moving. And just to make absolutely sure this fellow understood his dog was dead, he got the cat and put it right in front of his nose again, lifted up one of the eyes, the dog, the cat, and the dog was absolutely stone dead. And so it was only after that the man actually sort of agreed that his dog was dead. And so the vet put the cat away in the cage and gave the man his bill. $535. The man couldn't believe. "What do you mean $535? It's only about 10 minutes work there." He said that was $35 for the initial examination and $500 for the CAT scan. So I thought I'd lighten up the talk in Anatta because it was a deep talk and it's a bit tight. But anyway, that's like denial. And this is one of the problems with Anatta. I mention this and I give this teaching out, but I don't expect anyone to take it on board, because you can't take it on board. All it has to be is a suggestion, which will only really bear fruit after you've experienced a decent jhana. Only then will you come out of that, and there's a good chance you'll look upon that jhana in that particular way. And you look, doer, it's gone. Only then can you accept a teaching like that. The moment there's no way you can, you haven't got enough data. Yeah? Okay, how does the concept of a stream mentor or once returner fit into this? The stream mentor and once returners and above, these are called like Aryans, noble ones. These are people who've seen non-self, who've actually seen that there's no person in there. And that has a consequence to it, that insight, that wisdom, that experience of seeing that there's completely emptiness inside here. There's not a doer, there's not a knower. But that which one takes to be a doer and what one takes to be a knower, that reality one sees for what it is, just the process. Now the result of that, when you see there's actually nothing here, there's nothing you own, nothing yours, it allows you to let go. When you don't own anything, you can give away everything. Only when you see that can true letting go start happening. And so the process which occurs after that is just a giving away of all those things you've accumulated over the lifetimes. And I'm not talking about physical things, I'm talking about mental things as well. All the attachments start to go from then on. And 7 lifetimes at the most. That's if you're a slow giver-awayer. For most people, it's much faster. Letting go, giving away. And giving away everything. Your body, perception, consciousness. Everything goes. and everything's gone, that's called parinibbana, the full all-round going out. It's what the Buddha did when he passed away, what the arahats do at the end of their life. No more rebirth, just the process is finished. But that can only be comprehended, that can only be allowed when you see there's nothing worth holding on to. There's nothing inside. You can only let go when you realize there's no one on this end of attachment. And the simile I always give is my hand. You know, with my hand, I'm always picking things up. That's what a hand is for. What do I expect? It's the nature of the hand to pick things up. The only way I can stop it picking things up, cut it off. Once it's cut off, I can't pick things up anymore. I can't attach to things. You've got to find what it is inside of you which keeps picking things up, which keeps attaching to things, which keeps accumulating and owning and possessing things. Find out that. That's called the illusion of self. Once you look at that and find it's just not what you expect it is, you've misunderstood it. It's not a self, it's not a me or mine. Then it's very easy to cut off that delusion. And that delusion is cut off, you're a stream entry. It's only a matter of time before the whole thing completely stops. There's no more picking up, you're just letting go. The ability to choose and wisdom, particularly how can one make wise decision if one has no independent choice? And the answer is actually comes from the suttas, hang out with wise people and read wise words. Then you find you make wise decisions. If you hang out with fools, then you make foolish decisions. That's why the Buddha once said, be careful of your companions. Better it is to be alone than to have fools for your companions. So that's one understanding of like programming. And also, just what you feed into your mind. If you feed in sort of like junk food, you know, TVs and stupid magazines, then you find actually that your choices will be reflected by, you know, the mental food which you eat. You look at yourself, your choices in life, where they're coming from. Why do you choose to wear the clothes you do? Why do you choose to go on the holidays you go to? Why do you choose to live in the house you live in? Is it really your choice, or has it been influenced by TV, by radio, by friends? It's interesting to see how we have something called fashions and fads, which is just a manifestation on how we influence one another, how we are so suggestive to each other, and how that it's so hard to have an independent choice. You know, one of the things which really shocked me when I was a teenager, because, you know, my hero was Jimi Hendrix, and so I had a hairstyle just like him. I wasn't always bald-headed. And I had a beard as well, and had sort of my hippie beads and green velvet trousers. And I thought I was being a rebel. Until I remember going to one of these rock concerts in the Isle of Wight and finding there were another 100,000 people exactly like me. I realised I wasn't a rebel anymore. And how, you know, what I thought was independent choice was being reflected in the independent so-called choice of 100,000 others. I'd been programmed just like everyone else had. You can't help it. You just pick up sort of and imitate one another. So it's, even if you're very careful and very mindful, sometimes it's amazing just how you're programmed.